From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. WGCU's Jessica Mazzaros recently sat down with researchers for a look at what they hope to learn from a 7,000-year-old indigenous burial site discovered by divers in the Gulf of Mexico near Venice about 2 years ago. We'll learn more about that find later in today's show. But first, today marks the start of the final week of Florida's 2018 regular lawmaking session. Since the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School that took the lives of 17 people last month, a great deal of attention in Tallahassee has been paid to ideas regarding firearms. We'll be exploring legislative proposals that may be falling below the radar in regards to abortion and women's reproductive rights, as well as language in a House tax package that had animal welfare advocates raising eyebrows. Before we get into those topics, however, the Florida Senate held a rare Saturday session this past weekend to hammer out legislation about gun regulation and school safety. Reporter Jessica Bakeman from our sister public radio station, WLRN in Miami, has been in Tallahassee covering this year's session. I recently sat down with her for a debrief of what came out of Saturday's Senate session and for a look at how these proposals are shaping up now in the 11th hour. Let's hear that conversation now.
So the Florida Senate held a rare Saturday session. They ended up spending about 8 hours debating amendments to a 100-page gun control and school safety bill that was crafted in response to the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. Some of the amendments were, well, most of them were by Democrats, and they were pretty much all voted down. I think one went through, but among them was a proposed ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. There was a brief, sort of dramatic moment where the Senate had approved an amendment that would have triggered a two-year moratorium on the sale of AR-15s, which was the type of weapon used in that shooting. It was approved on a voice vote, but then about 15 minutes later, a Republican senator asked for the vote to be reconsidered, and they took a roll call, and it ended up failing 21-17. So for about 15 minutes, it looks like that might happen, but other than that, pretty much any hopes that gun control advocates had for an assault weapons ban, something going farther than what is in the bill, which is raising the purchasing age from 18 to 21 and also implementing a three-day waiting period for gun purchases, that looks like it's about as far as the legislature is going to go in terms of gun control. And that's if the House, the Senate still has to approve the final bill, and then it goes to the House, where its chances could be a little bit tougher because it's more conservative and you have more people there who are concerned about the NRA and Second Amendment voters, basically. And then there's always the governor as well. Of course, he has to sign it. And he has said that he opposes arming teachers, which that provision is still in the bill as of now. So it's pretty up in the air as to what's going to happen this week, and it is the last week of the legislative session.
Yeah, very unusual to have, this close to the end, so many things up in the air here. And of course, as you've been reporting, the surge of lobbying efforts we've seen in Tallahassee since the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School mass shooting has been from people who want to see something done about the availability of automatic or semi-automatic rifles and high-capacity magazines. Were there folks, from Parkland who had been lobbying there throughout the week attending on Saturday that you noticed?
There was a small group of people wearing red T-shirts that say Moms Demand Action, who were there on Saturday. The big crowd that we had seen in the weeks leading up to this vote, they were not there, and there doesn't seem to be a huge crowd of protesters here, but certainly their concerns are very much felt. The people who survived the shooting, their families, the families of the people who didn't survive, the 17 people who died, have been at the Capitol having meetings with legislators through the past couple of weeks, lobbying for this bill, lobbying for changes to this bill. So I think they're definitely in lawmakers' minds. A couple of the Democrats who were pushing for the assault weapons ban said, this was the number one thing that the students asked for. And ultimately, that amendment also got 17 votes in the affirmative, and that was the Senate's 15 senators, Democratic senators, as well as two Republicans, Anna Terry Flores and Renee Garcia, were both from Miami. They have moderate districts, and they also are not facing re-election this year because of term limits.
Well, Jessica Bakeman with WLRN, thank you so much for your reporting and for taking the time to be with us this afternoon. And, you know, we look forward to any future updates with just 1 week left.
Okay, thanks.
That was WLRN reporter Jessica Bakeman, who's covering this year's state legislative session in Tallahassee, discussing this past Saturday's rare Senate session addressing gun control and school safety. Now we turn our attention to the Florida House, which last week passed a bill that would place new restrictions on doctors performing the most common type of second trimester abortions, known as dilation and evacuation abortions. The procedure involves dilating a woman's cervix and removing the fetus in pieces. Opponents of the procedure call it dismemberment abortion and use that term in the bill language. The proposal, sponsored by Republican Representative Aaron Grawl of Vero Beach, prohibits the procedure unless the heart of a fetus is stopped first by injection of a drug or through another procedure. The bill language also includes exceptions and instances where a woman's life is in danger and no other medical procedure would suffice. Representative Grawl calls the bill a middle ground for her, given her staunch opposition to abortion. But opponents, like Democratic Representative Amy Mercado of Orlando, argue that the bill would present substantial obstacles to a woman's right to an abortion under both state and federal law. The bill passed the state House last Thursday on a largely party-line vote, with Republicans in support and Democrats opposed. A companion measure in the Senate has not yet been heard, with just 1 week left in the annual session. Joining me now for a closer look at the bill and for a broader discussion on the political climate here in Florida when it comes to women's reproductive rights is Amy Weintraub. She's the Reproductive Rights Program Director for the nonprofit Progress Florida. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, my gosh. It's a pleasure to be here.
And before we get into our conversation, I first wanted to play a voice for our listeners from someone in support of the bill. And this is Dr. Kathy Altman. She's a board certified OBGYN and a fellow of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. After having performed abortion procedures herself, including the specific one targeted by this bill, and serving previously as the director of Planned Parenthood in the Jacksonville area, she took up a pro-life position. And Dr. Altman testified in favor of the bill last month before the House Health and Human Services Committee. We're just going to hear some of that testimony now.
I'm a retired board-certified OBGYN and a fellow of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. With over 35 years of experience here in Florida, I earned my medical degree at University of Florida College of Medicine and completed my OBGYN residency at the University Health Education Program in Jacksonville. I've been an advocate for women and their health issues for my entire career. I was a co-founder and co-director of the First Rate Treatment Center in Jacksonville, and performed sexual assault exams on women and children as a medical examiner for Duval and Clay counties. I performed first trimester suction D&C abortions and sought out special training in second trimester D&E, or otherwise known as dismemberment abortions. I also served as the medical director for Planned Parenthood of Jacksonville in 1981 to 1983. My experiences doing abortions and those in my OBGYN practice led me to a pro-life position. I have subsequently testified extensively at the state and national level on a variety of pro-life issues. I'm an associate scholar with the Charlotte Lozier Institute and a member of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. A dismemberment procedure, or D&E, is done between 13 to 24 weeks gestation when the tissue becomes too tough to be removed with a suction curette alone. Patients are brought in 1 to 2 days prior to the procedure for laminaria insertion to dilate the cervix. On the day of the procedure, I would examine the patient, I'd insert a speculum, remove the laminaria, put on an antiseptic. Back then, we only used local in the cervix. Nowadays, I think they have more, you know, better ways of anesthetizing patients. I would grasp the cervix with a tenaculum or an Alice. Then I would insert. I would usually take a dilator, a small dilator, to check the direction of the canal. and if necessary, dilate the cervix a little further so that I could insert my suction cannula. So I'd insert my suction cannula, attach it to suction. It would suction out the amniotic fluid, and it would also bring the baby down into the lower portion of the uterus. At that point, I would insert a clamp and try to grab. I'd feel around a little bit and then try to grab whatever I could grab, usually an arm or a leg. And because the cervical opening was smaller than the baby, then I was able to clamp on that part and kind of twist and pull that part off. I'd keep doing that until I couldn't grab anything else. Then I would open the clamp a little further so that I could grasp the thorax. The thorax was pretty big. Crush the thorax, pull that out, and then try to grasp the head. And this was always the scary part, because the further along a woman is, the thinner her uterus becomes, and the more likely it is to go right through that thin wall and grab a portion of the woman's bowel or her bladder or something else. Thankfully, I never did that, but we did have a woman come into our emergency room where she'd had that happen, and a piece of her bowel had been removed, and she almost died. Once I grab the head and crush the head, I can tell because of the white liquid that drains out, which is the brains, and then I just try to get all the pieces of the skull. I then would normally take a sharp curette, a large sharp curette, just to kind of feel the walls and get any bits of placenta or anything, any other bits of tissue out, and then put the suction in one more time, sweep around and make sure I got most of the blood and any tiny parts of tissue. Once I was sure the bleeding was controlled and I'd had all the parts, I would normally put them in a tray and then line them all up to make sure they were all there. And then that would be I'd remove the speculum, and that's the end of the procedure. Excuse me. I support this bill because it prevents the infliction of needless pain and suffering on an innocent human being with only minor inconvenience to the mother and the abortionist. It does not interfere with a woman's ability to obtain an abortion. A major benefit is that it will spare mothers the agony and guilt of knowing that they consented to a procedure that caused their child to be torn limb from limb while it was alive. And oftentimes women don't find out about that until later. The technology to cause fetal death prior to the second trimester abortion is already standard practice in many abortion clinics for this very reason. What bothers me is that at the time I was doing these procedures, I was so concerned with terminating the pregnancy for my patient because she didn't want it, that I never even considered what the baby was experiencing. I didn't see the fetus as any different than a chick embryo that I dissected in college. Because I didn't see the fetus as a human being, my conscience was not affected by what I did. It wasn't until after I had my own baby that I made the baby-fetus connection. The fact that the baby was unwanted was no longer enough justification for me to kill it, and I could no longer do abortions. I hope that you have more compassion for these innocent little human beings than I did and pass this bill. We regulate the way in which animals are killed to prevent this kind of cruelty. Certainly, we owe as much to our own babies. Thank you.
That was retired OBGYN Dr. Kathy Altman testifying last month before the Florida House Health and Human Services Committee in favor of a bill that proposes new restrictions on doctors performing second trimester dilation and evacuation abortion procedures. That measure again was approved late last week by the full House. And we're speaking live today with Amy Weintraub, the Reproductive Rights Program Director for the nonprofit Florida Progress. Once again, Amy, welcome to the show. And I just wanted to get your reaction to Dr. Altman's testimony there, and tell us just some more background about this procedure and what these proposed new restrictions could mean for women.
Well, Dr. Altman is
is speaking in opposition to what the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists say. And this is a group that she's a part of, but nationally they've come out with a really strong statement to say that any effort to ban specific types of procedures, such as this bill is trying to do, is going to limit the ability of doctors to provide their patients with the medically appropriate care that they need. And it will likely result in worsened outcomes and increased complications. And what we know is that these legislative efforts are based on non-medical subjective language, which is what Dr. Altman was using. And it creates confusion. Things like the title that the extremists have given this bill in the Florida legislature, it creates confusion, and ultimately it puts women at risk, and it actually can lead to abortion later in pregnancy.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, and I thought I was a little surprised to see the term dismemberment abortion in the language of the bill, given that this procedure does have a medically recognized name, and we're talking about state statute. I mean, this is an area where precision of language would be pretty important, I would think.
Absolutely. So you can tell that precision of language is not what's important here. What's to the people who are sponsoring the bill, what's important is for them to use charged language that will get people's attention and that will have an emotional impact.
And how will imposing these new restrictions on the specific second trimester abortion procedure, what are your concerns about how this could impact women?
Well, it is the by far the most common method of second trimester abortion in the United States. And so banning this specific kind of procedure basically outlaws what most women would access if they needed an abortion in their second trimester.
So are there other second trimester procedures that do exist, but that would just be more risky to the woman's life or health?
Correct. And they take longer, and they're more expensive, and they take a bigger toll on the woman. For example, medication abortion could work, but it does not have as high of an efficacy rate, and it takes days. It's also less predictable. Some women react to medication differently than others. And so this is by far the safest and most predictable and as I said earlier, most used method for second trimester abortion.
And it seems like, well, as I'm interpreting the bill language here, it looks like they're not banning the procedure necessarily, but they're just saying that the fetus's heart would need to be stopped first, and then Dr. Altman gets into this a great deal in her own testimony, because of, you know, a fetus at that stage of development's ability to experience pain.
Like, this whole pain-capable business has been shown time and again to be a fabrication of extremists, and there's just no evidence that the fetus is pain-capable during the second trimester. I just might also mention that this is a highly unconstitutional bill. I mean, the Supreme Court state courts and federal courts have already, and other states that have attempted this, have already blocked the implementation of the bill. Kansas, Oklahoma, Alabama, Louisiana, Texas, Arkansas. So this is just, even if it were to pass, it would cost Florida so much money.
So you're saying this is...
In order to defend it.
So you're saying this is definitely going to be setting the stage for lawsuits down the road then?
100%. It would be challenged in court because it is unconstitutional.
And to my knowledge, the bill's Senate companion hasn't moved really much at all in this year's session. With just 1 week left to go, do you feel fairly confident that this isn't going to pass, at least in 2018?
Of course, we are always watching carefully until the bell rings at the end of the session. But yes, we aren't seeing much traction in the Senate. That is correct.
And just taking a step back from this bill specifically, I wanted to get a broader perspective on Florida's political environment when it comes to women's reproductive rights. For starters, the lawmakers that filed this bill in January did so on the very same day that a Tallahassee judge permanently blocked Florida from forcing women to seek abortions to undergo a 24-hour waiting period first. And it's certainly not the only bill relating to women's reproductive health that has raised red flags with Progress Florida and other groups. How would you characterize the climate here in Florida when it comes to women's reproductive rights?
As long as the, conservative extremists have a hold on both the House and the Senate and right now the governor's office, you know, this anti-abortion strategy is always going to have legs. It definitely, we see this, all of these sort of abortion ban or method bans or 24-hour waiting periods or any of these things that sort of chip away at a woman's right to choose or that impose extra barriers. We see them absolutely as part of a larger anti-abortion strategy that our opposition is reigning nationally, actually. And so we are always on alert, and we will always be diligent in watching and countering their voices.
In regards to what you're watching this time around, in a previous edition of this program, we focused in on a bill looking to cement state funding for what are, you know, are overtly pro-life pregnancy crisis centers. What can you tell me about Progress Florida's position there and where that proposal stands?
Yeah, we're waiting for the governor to sign that bill, although we're working hard to get him to veto it. And absolutely, it is. These crisis pregnancy centers are fake clinics that are set up to fool or to trick women who aren't seeking health care to come in their doors by putting signs out that say, you know, think you might be pregnant, get a free pregnancy test here, and then commence to talking them out of accessing abortion care. Women are often fooled and think that they're going to an actual health care provider when, in fact, the people who are working there are not clinicians. They are not trained in helping women access the care that they need. And, in fact, they do the exact opposite.
Okay.
So we definitely we in Progress Florida have a strong need to educate the public on this, and we will be working on that in the coming year to make sure that girls and women in Florida are armed with the information that they need and don't access these fake clinics.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the program, but thanks so much to my guest, Amy Weintraub. She's the Reproductive Rights Program Director for the nonprofit Progress Florida. Great to speak with you.
Thank you very much.
Earlier, we heard a recording of Dr. Kathy Altman of the Charlotte Lozier Institute testifying last month before the Florida House Committee on Health and Human Services. We're taking a short break right now, but when we return, our legislative roundtable edition of Gulf Coast Live continues as we explore a move in the Florida House that animal advocates worried could have voided existing local ordinances in the state to ban the sale of animals from pet stores who are bred in poor conditions, often are in what are referred to as puppy mills. That conversation's just ahead. Stay with us. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. A $350 million tax package that's been advancing in the State House recently had animal advocates concerned due to a last-minute amendment that could have taken away a local government's ability to ban the sale of pets like dogs and cats that come from commercial breeders. It also could have voided existing bans from Florida municipalities that have already enacted such prohibitions, including the city of St. Petersburg and Hillsborough and Sarasota counties. The Sarasota ban actually prompted a lawsuit against the county by Petland Sarasota. We should note that the exemption language in that tax legislation has since been removed, but we're still exploring the issue in today's show, given that animal welfare advocates say that pet shelters are already overwhelmed and that banning the sale of pets from commercial breeders would help reduce the number of animals in need of forever homes. They also accuse retail pet stores of acquiring animals, mainly dogs, from puppy mills, where animals are sick and often kept in poor conditions. Opponents, including pet store owners, refute that claim, saying they purchase from reputable breeders and that such bans work to put them out of business. They also say that people shopping for specific dog breeds won't go to shelters, but rather will turn to backyard breeders who are poorly regulated. Joining me now for a closer look at the situation are Lindsay Laris and Kelsey Eberle with the Animal League Defense Fund. Laris is the organization's Director of Legislative Affairs, and Eberle is also an attorney leading the group's case against Petland. Thanks both of you for your time today, and welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hi, thank you.
It's great to be here.
And so since the specific amendment in this Florida House tax package that led to today's discussion has been removed, I was hoping you could provide some broader context when it comes to states in the U.S. looking to preempt local municipalities from taking steps to prevent the sale of animals from unscrupulous breeders. Is this common?
I'm sorry, you're referring to like other states that have tried these sort of bans?
Yes.
I think there's been several states that have tried that. Kelsey has looked into this as well. I know that Georgia was trying to implement a ban such as this. Missouri has some similar language that's in session right now that kind of covers all local municipalities from any animal welfare regulations. So I know the city of St. Louis has horse carriage bans that they're looking at making happen there, and this sort of language would get rid of those bans, basically making that a state issue.
And Lindsay Laris, how did this even come up on your radar? Because the language of the bill, you know, it never uses terms like pet store.
Right.
I mean, do you think this was intentionally vague to maybe not set off your radar?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, that these bills have been kind of poking around in legislative sessions for the past 2 years, and in Florida last year specifically. So we actually, the Animal Legal Defense Fund has a lobbyist in Florida who was there the day that this was being introduced as this last-minute addendum to a tax bill in the House, and sort of called me right away. And some ASPCA and HSUS lobbyists were also aware that this was going on. So it was sort of an immediate effort by those folks who were on the ground, the lobbyists that all of us have on the ground in Tallahassee, to recognize this language because we've seen it before and to know that this what the intent was there.
Right. Well, let's just, in case there's somebody out here who's not familiar with the concept, what exactly is a puppy mill here, and what kinds of conditions are we talking about when we recognize that these are not good?
So
a puppy mill is a mass breeding operation, dog breeding operation. Puppy mills are known for having extremely inhumane conditions. Inbreeding, cruelty to the mother dogs who are forced to give birth to puppies over and over again. Animals are often kept in small wire cages without adequate protection from the elements. These are really situations that puppy buying customers find abhorrent, which is why so many towns and cities across the country have taken the step of actually banning the retail sale of animals because, the pet stores rely on these puppy mills to provide a steady supply of puppies.
Well, and Kelsey, I want to get your response to this next clip we're about to play. And this is from a conversation we had on this program a couple of years ago with Petland CEO, Joe Watson. He told us that Petland is active in working with breeders to promote education and best practices, and says that they can help curb puppy mills, which is the goal of, you know, really anyone who cares about pets.
We're visiting breeders. We're doing our homework, and we have sourcing requirements. Pet store bans will only force that level of activity to go away. We don't see the Humane Society of the United States, we don't see Corey and the ASPCA at any of the breeder conferences visiting breeders or providing any breeder education when all the pet stores in the United States are closed, if that's their goal. Not a single breeder will go out of business, and not a single puppy mill has gone out of business due to any of the bans that have been passed thus far. So while we all are passionate, we all have a common goal of putting puppy mills out of business, the reality is we come at this from a different perspective. We believe that boots on the ground, educating people, influencing people is the best avenue.
Kelsey, I've been looking at some details of the Animal Legal Defense Fund's nationwide racketeering class action suit against Petland, and I imagine you'd take issue with that.
Yeah, I mean, the way that the CEO describes their work to combat puppy mills, just it can't really be believed. Petland depends on these mass breeding operations, as I said, to provide a steady supply of puppies And while they claim that they have these, you know, standards for breeders, you know, what we've heard is that all they require is perhaps that, you know, breeders be USDA licensed. But, of course, it's certainly possible for a puppy mill to obtain and keep its license. And the licensure by the USDA is no guarantee that a breeder is not a puppy mill. And the reason that so many people are turning away from, you know, buying a pet at a pet store is that they don't want to patronize, you know, these mass breeding operations, puppy mills, and that so often the dogs who come from these puppy mills are prone to a variety of deadly diseases and genetic conditions and really bring heartbreak and enormous veterinary bills to the customers who buy them. So there are so many reasons to, you know, not purchase a puppy from a pet store, and you know, the puppy mill sourcing is just one of those reasons.
Why is this suit specifically targeting Petland? Is it just because their size? They're all over the country. They're in other countries as well.
Petland has a scheme with the way it sells animals. These animals are sold for sometimes several $1,000, $3,000, $4,000.
I've seen that.
Mm-hmm. And the way that Petland gets people to pay that much money is by these fraudulent guarantees about the health of the dogs. So the dogs, you know, are coming from these mass breeding operations, but Petland lies to customers and tells them that the dogs have been checked out by a veterinarian, that they're healthy and happy and fit to go home, when in reality, it either knows that they're sick, or even if it doesn't know that they're sick, it knows that they come from these breeding operations where, you know, sickness is incredibly likely. So that's a fraud against consumers. And, in fact, it violates the federal RICO statute, and that's what our lawsuit is about.
Okay. You know, Watson also told us that, you know, of the 10,000 or so breeders in the U.S., only 17% are licensed by the USDA through an inspection process. And these are the ones that pet stores can legally buy from to sell to consumers. So fewer than 2% of puppies are obtained at pet stores, and those have had to come from USDA certified breeders.
Through breeder conferences, we work with those 17%. Through visitations, our franchisees, our corporate staff visit the breeders. We have a do not buy list because some of those 17% don't match the criteria that we have established. And so by being at the breeder's facility, taking pictures, showing our customers in our stores, our breeder books, these are the breeders we buy from, we feel that provides the customer some transparency back to where these puppies come from.
And you know, once again, Kelsey, I imagine that with this being a class action lawsuit, there's a number of folks you're working with who did not have an experience with Petland, as we just heard described by the CEO.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, if Petland was taking care to, you know, pick out its breeders and to source its puppies only from, you know, family breeders or humane breeders, then it wouldn't be seeing the scores of customers, you know, coming forward to us with just such similar tales of buying a sick dog, then taking it to one of Petland's veterinarians, their preferred veterinarian, and, you know, having that person tell them, you know, basically give them the runaround. And, you know, the customer and their family is devastated with the sickness or death of their new puppy. That story has just been told over and over again. That's not a story that comes out of a company that's doing everything right with regard to, you know, how it sells puppies.
And are puppy mills legal? And by that I mean we know it's not legal to mistreat animals, but just in terms of the regulatory environment that exists or lack thereof, would you maybe consider them legal?
That's a hard question. Go ahead, Lindsay.
I was just going to say that, and I'm not sure if you hit the specific point yet, Kelsey, but so the definition of a puppy mill is basically a place that puts profits over the welfare of the animals.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there isn't this, like, people say puppy mill, you think, oh, it has to be a place that dogs are, you know, really being horribly, horribly physically abused affirmatively. That's not always the case. So I think that, you know, they can be legal, but in some sense, that are the USDA certified? Yes. Does that mean that somebody thinks that when they're buying from a place that is USDA certified, that they're getting from a place that has 1,000 dogs on the property where the breeders are perfectly comfortable shipping 7-week-old dogs across the country for sale. I don't think that's what your average consumer feels like they're buying when they purchase a dog from a pet store, being told it's from a reputable USDA licensed breeder.
Right.
And there's sort of that disconnect there.
Well, we just got a couple minutes left here, but Kelsey, quickly, can you tell us about the status of this ongoing class action lawsuit invoking both the federal and state of Georgia's RICO acts?
Sure. So we filed a suit last summer and then faced motions to dismiss by all three defendants, and we're currently waiting for a decision from the court on those motions, and we're hopeful that we'll prevail and that we'll be able to continue into discovery and investigating our claims and getting some justice for the, the thousands of pet and customers who've been harmed by the store, and of course for the dogs.
And of course, we'll be checking back in with both of you as this continues and as this suit develops. But that is all the time we have for this portion of the show, unfortunately. But thanks so much to my guests, Lindsay Laris and Kelsey Eberle with the Animal League Defense Fund. Laris is the organization's director of legislative affairs, and Eberle is an attorney also leading the group's case against Petland. Thanks to both of you for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And this is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. We close out today's show with some non-legislative news. A 7,000-year-old indigenous burial site was discovered in the Gulf of Mexico near Venice about 2 years ago. The Florida Department of State just announced the find and the ongoing research. This is the first site showing that this kind of preservation can exist on the continental shelf, surviving hurricanes and sea level rise. WGCU's Jessica Mazzaro spoke with the Department of State's underwater archaeology supervisor, Ryan Duggins, and with Florida Gulf Coast University's Heather Walsh Haney, who's helping with the research. Let's hear their conversation.
A 7,000-year-old burial site in Gulf of Mexico. Do either of you want to just introduce, like, what is this site? What are we talking about here?
What we have is the first example in North or South America of a prehistoric offshore archaeological site that contains a lot of sensitive and delicate organic materials in a preserved, drowned paleo landscape.
I've heard that there's this particular area where it's found is something unprecedented. What does that mean?
It is. So we, historically, underwater archaeologists are focusing on historic period shipwrecks. And in the past couple decades, there's been a push and a focus growing on submerged prehistoric sites. But the continental shelves of North America have yet to really demonstrate that they can hold archaeological sites with wood, with bones, with organic materials that normally decay on terrestrial sites. And what this site demonstrates is that here we have not only this drowned landscape that contains the remnants of what used to be a small freshwater pond 7,000 years ago, but that landscape that was covered up by rising sea levels also contains evidence of interments, burial interments from Florida's indigenous peoples. And that's what's really remarkable about this site, is that it now demonstrates that thousands of years of hurricanes and the violent effects of Holocene sea level rise, even as drastic as that can be, doesn't mean that the archaeology on the continental shelf has all been destroyed.
And have you actually, either of you, been out there? Have you seen it with your own eyes?
We've both been out
there.
What does it look like?
It's one of those things, and I've seen many archaeological sites, and this is the only one that still kind of, I have to take a deep breath before I splash every time, because while it's only in 21 feet of water, it's not a very deep site. It's unlike anything I'd ever really seen before. We dropped down. I remember that first dive that we saw it. We dropped down, and there coming out of the seafloor are wooden stakes with an exposed peat bottom with human skeletal material that in some cases was actually mobile. So it had broken free from the seafloor and was tumbling around. In other cases, there were still in situ or firmly affixed material on the seafloor.
And how would you describe it, Heather? For you, is it kind of the same? Do you have to take a deep breath before going down? What was your experience seeing it for the first time?
Well, my experience seeing it is very different because I don't dive. So I was topside. I was on the deck of the boat helping the archaeologists determine if the areas they were looking in contained human remains and if the free-floating material was actually human remains. So I could do that remotely because occasionally they had cameras down there and then they had a laptop up above and I could look at the laptop. Other times they would actually bring up bags of material and then immediately right then I could tell them, this is something we need to be concerned about.
And what has this project been like for you in terms of, have you ever worked on anything like this before, Heather?
I've never worked on a active archaeological scene that is underwater. During my master's and my PhD, I had the privilege and honor to evaluate human burials from the sites of Wendover and Bay West. So my eye is calibrated to recognize this kind of material, but my day-to-day operations tend to be dealing with modern cases involving skeletal remains.
And so this was just recently announced, even though it was discovered in 2016, right? So is this something that you guys have had to keep kind of secret?
Well, for me, it was very reminiscent of how we deal with current forensic cases in that we have to keep information close to our chest because we have to talk with all the stakeholders. And then, of course, Ryan and the Department of State and the Seminole were, I'm just a tool for them.
How much work is there left to do? So you've been looking at this for 2 years. There's only so much that you can probably dig up, right? I mean, I don't know like what the limits are of the amount of things that you guys can pull up and examine. Is there kind of a limit there?
Well, right now our focus at the Department of State has really been to try to get our heads around the scale and the scope of the site. That is how big it is and how deep the deposit is. And we're trying to determine that so that we can develop a long-term plan to manage and protect the site. So not just for the next 6 weeks, but maybe the next 6 years and maybe even 60 years. What can we do today that might help stabilize and preserve it? Because that's a concern that we at the state and also the Seminole and at the county level are really concerned about. I mean, this is not a site that we can... we can't fence it off and put a sign up because it's in the Gulf of Mexico. And so what we've been trying to do is through a lot of coordination with state and local law enforcement, with local homeowners, with the local community and dive shops, is to, over the past few months and actually the past year, is really kind of all put our brains together and try to figure out possible ways that we can make sure that this site is not disturbed either accidentally with someone dropping an anchor or someone accidentally finding material while they're looking for shark's teeth, but also not intentionally disturbed with people who are artifact hunters who want to loot the site.
I'm wondering, what are some protections out there right now? I understand law enforcement is kind of monitoring the area, even though the official area has not really been announced.
That's correct. So there's state laws that protect the site. It's against the law to disturb it, to even attempt to disturb it, and certainly to collect anything from it. And we've been working closely with the Sarasota County Sheriff's Department, the Venice Police Department's Marine Patrol, and Florida Fish and Wildlife to make sure that there are regular eyes on the site, just to make sure that it's not going to be damaged.
So, do we know who these people are? The people that you've discovered and you're studying?
Well, we know via radiocarbon dating on two of the wooden stakes that were used in the burial practice that these remains are associated with Florida's indigenous peoples dating back over 7,200 years ago. And that is remarkable to have that kind of preservation and that evidence out on the continental shelf.
Is there any kind of conversation being had with the existing indigenous populations here?
Yeah, we've had a lot of close consultation and conversation with the Seminole Tribe of Florida's Tribal Historic Preservation Office, and their concerns lie just in line with ours. That is that this is a site that we need to make sure is not going to be damaged or not going to be looted and needs to be protected. And they've been a great partner through this process, and it's been a great opportunity to brainstorm, certain ways in which we can get the message out to the broader population and to make sure that people know the significance and the sensitivity of the site.
What has this project meant for your career? Because I imagine you guys do this because you love what you do, and then something like this pops up. I mean, I just wonder, what has this meant for you?
Well, for me, it's been eye-opening to have a chance to meet and talk to all of the various stakeholders, because that's not something that happens a lot, especially in the United States. I often work in Latin America, and it's amazing to see how families and indigenous groups work with an outsider like a forensic anthropologist from the United States. And to be part of this large team where everyone has input is amazing.
And how about for you, Ryan? What has this project meant to you and your career?
You know, from a personal standpoint, my dissertation research was all about the potential for the continental shelf of the Gulf of Mexico to contain archaeological sites, prehistoric archaeological sites. And so in many ways, you know, this is an amazing find. Now, professionally, I want to echo Heather's sentiment that it's been just such a unique privilege to get to work so closely with so many different stakeholders in a way that, you know, I think is rather unique as far as archaeological projects go. We really are working with state and federal and indigenous groups and local communities and homeowners in such a way that I feel just really, really pleased that we've all been able to come together around one table and think about the best ways we can manage and share what we've learned about this site.
Do you have any idea of when you'll get to release some of the things that you found?
Well, for my work, one of the research tasks I've been charged with, you know, talking with Ryan and then talking with representatives from TIPO, is to design a project that will allow me to test the effect of different substrates used to cap the site and protect it. And I envision using non-human cadavers and, you know, finding an inlet with similar water values, turbidity, pH, salinity, and you know, taking the time to see how those cadavers are affected, but be it by Venice sand brought in from other areas, even cement perhaps.
Ryan, do you want to add to that at all? Or
yeah, one of the things that we're working on is to determine the remote sensing signature of a site like this. So archaeological research projects conducted in waters require certain tools to be used, side-scan sonar and a sub-bottom profiler. And what we're hoping to do is really pinpoint what this site looks like using those tools so that other researchers across the state and across the country can use that as a marker for an area that might contain archaeological material.
Great. Is there anything that we have not talked about that either of you would like to mention before we conclude?
I know that this experience has led me to finally consider diving. So I won't have to be topside all the time.
How about you, Ryan? Anything that you'd like to mention before we conclude?
I would just like to stress to all of Florida's divers that are in our waters all the time that if they find something that they think might be significant, whether it's perhaps an arrowhead or perhaps an anchor or basically anything that catches their eye that they think might be archaeologically significant, I encourage them to contact our office, send us a picture. It might be a new site that we can give them some additional information on, or perhaps in the case of what happened at Manasota Key, it could be a whole new site that could result in a lot of neat work. So that's what I'd like to say.
Well, thank you both so much for your time today. I know you're very busy, but thank you for your work and thank you for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
That was WGCU's Jessica Mazzaro speaking with Ryan Duggins of the Florida Department of State and with FGCU researcher Heather Walsh-Haney about the 7,000-year-old Native American burial site discovered in Gulf waters. That's all the time we have for today's program. Our show was produced by Julie Glenn, Mike Canary, Jessica Mazzaros, and yours truly. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm John Davis. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.